Hello everyone and welcome to Science Spinning, the show that brings science to the people here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Duke. This week in What's It All About, we're going to talk about the Human Genome Project with Tommy McCarthy of UCC. This project has been on the go now for 10 years and we might just have a look at where it stands and what changes it's going to bring for all of us. We'll also be talking about whether humans should really bother exploring space, given the amount of resources that goes into exploring space. We'll be talking to James Geary. He's a European Space Agency engineer for our Question Is slot. And finally, for the writer's room, we'll be talking to Wallace Arthur. He's a professor of zoology at UCC. He's written a book called Evolution, A Developmental Approach. There's been lots of books about evolution, going right back to Darwin's time, of course. It's a very popular subject, lots of study, but he has a slightly different take on evolution. But first of all, today, I'm going to be talking about the human genome. Well, just to give you a brief introduction to the human genome, it's a sequence of three trillion DNA base pairs, and it carries the full blueprint for human life. Now, the entire information for our DNA is contained within that genome, and the cost of sequencing it has plummeted from over €1 billion about 10 years ago in 2001 to about €10,000 last year. Now, it's estimated that it might cost less than a summer holiday by 2015. And the idea is, at this point in time, we may just visit our doctor with our genome on our mobile phone, and that'll have information about our future health, our character, our personality, lots of other stuff. So it's a very interesting topic. And to discuss this, I have on the line Tommy McCarthy, who gave a lecture on this as part of an outreach at University College Cork recently. Welcome to the programme, Tommy.
Hi, Sean, how are you doing?
Now, I've kind of outlined your talk there, but this is a very fast-moving area, so I suppose we could start with 2001. It was extremely expensive back then to get your entire genetic information, fully sequenced, but that's changed in the interim.
That's right, yeah. I think the estimates were the first genome cost, I think it was almost €3 billion, which was finally completed around 2003. And the original genome, it's a bit like computers. It required fairly large equipment in the first round, whereas in the intervening years, everything has been miniaturized, and that's dropped the costs fairly dramatically. And then the kind of technology has improved dramatically as well. So right now it's down to possibly under €10,000 per genome.
Okay, maybe you could give a shot at explaining to our general listeners the human genome. What is it, if they're trying to visualize what it is, this thing that codes everything from eye color to height to personality, everything?
Yeah, the way I think about it is it's our body is made up of cells. We have about 100 trillion cells. So if you understand the cell, you can understand the body to a certain extent. So each cell within it has about 30,000 or so little nanomachines that go around chopping up things and making the cell tick. So there are these little molecules or proteins flying around within the cell all the time. And to make those, you need instructions. So the instruction manuals, in a sense, for making all these little nanomachines is the genome or the DNA. And that manual, in a sense, is about... we have 23 copies of the instruction manual, and we have 23 instruction manuals and two copies of each. And the instruction manuals are enormous, but nonetheless, they're still instruction manuals. The approximate relative size, in a sense, would be if you had a library of 5,000 books and you had two copies of the library, that would be what your genome was. And then within that library, there's about 30,000 key chapters for these nanomachines for how to make them.
Okay, and we all have our own unique genome, is that right?
We're all somewhat unique. Well, we're more similar than different.
Okay.
So we're 99.9% the same, or 99.8% the same, and then we're 0.1 or 0.2% different. But when you put that in terms of the size of the genome, that's actually quite large. So we have about, if I was to compare my genome with yours, for example, a million differences. And those differences then are what make each human look different.
Of course, and they can be critical because, as we come on to now, that could have some information about what may happen to your future health, etc.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, it's a fast-moving area, and obviously, you know, you're envisaging in a note that you sent me that, you know, a doctor could have the gene. You could go into your doctor with your genome on your mobile phone as a commonplace thing. Is that not a bit science fiction-y, or is that something that's really going to happen soon?
It's on the way. I think what the mobile phone will do will be it'll link you up to the internet where your genome will reside, because mm-hmm. it's probably going to be a bit big for the mobile phone. But nonetheless, the access to it will be as simple as going on any of the internet sites.
Mm-hmm.
The way I envisage it is, because the cost is dropping, once it drops to a level where somebody will have it done for a hobby almost, a lot of people may sign up to have their genome sequenced, and at that point, then there'll be many people walking around who have their genome with them on their, or access to the genome with them on their mobile phone.
Mm-hmm.
And the current predictions are this year there'll be about 30,000 genomes sequenced across the world. Last year there was a couple of hundred, and then it'll escalate another tenfold the following year, and then by certainly by 5 years' time, you'd expect there to be several million genomes sequenced.
Mm.
And at that point, it'll be up to, the question will be not, is it possible to have your genome sequenced? But one will be asking oneself the question, well, do I want my genome sequenced, and what's it going to tell me?
Yeah, because it might contain information that we don't want to know about, obviously, because it gives you a picture of maybe a genetic disease that might hit you in your 40s when you're in your 30s or something like that.
That's right, yeah. Now, I guess one way to think about that is that whether the information would be positive or negative, and I've been thinking about it myself, you know, so, I mean, I have a grown-up family at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a big family myself. My wife comes from a big family. And because of that, you actually know a lot about your genome already, even though you don't exactly know.
Sure, you hear the stories about.
Yeah, and a lot of that is actually, you know, comes from what your genome looks like. So for people like me, the value in having your genome sequenced is it's less than if you had a small family, let's say. And because of my age, then as I'm older, it has less information for going on than if I were younger.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, most of the information, I think it will work out that most of the information you'll be able to at least to try to do something about it. I mean, even if it's certainly if it's any kind of cancer that you have a susceptibility to it, that's certainly a positive thing to find, because you can do something about it and be more proactive in screening and so on.
Sure, sure.
But
even if it's
diseases like Alzheimer's, which are fairly tough to think about, even those you can kind of stave them off a little bit with different exercise regimes or mental exercises.
It gives you the opportunity to do something about it, yeah.
Yeah.
And just to finish, because we're just slightly tight on time, would you be a little bit concerned that people may be forced to give their genome information to maybe an insurance company or people that are an employer? Do you think that's a danger that might happen in the future?
That's hard to know. I mean, at the individual level, I would say it's something to be quite concerned about. From a population level, it's actually going to be of benefit to the insurance companies and stuff, because I think inevitably it will drive costs down because we'll all take more care of ourselves. But at the individual level, certainly I wouldn't be sharing my genome with anybody.
Yeah, sure, sure. I'd feel the same way. But listen, thanks very much in coming on and telling us about that very interesting topic. You gave a lecture on it recently. There's a public lecture series at UCC. It's an ongoing series. Thanks for coming on. That's Tommy McCarthy's professor at UCC. He was telling us about the human genome and some implications for all of us. Now, this week, did you see? Well, we all know that when a drug gets tested, that you need, in the initial stages, if it's going to be a human drug, that you need typically lab mice that are involved to better test the efficacy, as it's called, of the drug candidates, to make sure that there's no serious toxic side effects before the drug is actually made widely available for human use. Now, this has been a major problem for a long time, because it's very expensive to have the initial stages of the testing on mice, and then it has to get into preclinical trials and onto humans, because even at quite a late stage, if it's been tested in mice, if it gets into human trials, effects can be seen then that actually weren't predicted with the animal or the mice models. And this, in economic terms, can be a disaster, because it can mean a drug is rejected, or it can cost hundreds of millions more than was anticipated because the whole process takes so long. Well, in that context, I thought a note I saw this week on a student, a PhD student in Harvard in the US. He has actually developed a mouse that is more human than was previously possible. What essentially he's done is he's found a way to humanize the mouse's liver, so that the liver is where all these toxins are dealt with. And if the mouse has a more human liver, a kind of a filament that he's developed, a bioengineered liver, then this gives a more accurate picture of how it might affect humans. This might slow, or might speed up, I should say, the whole process of drug development and save drug companies hundreds of millions. Okay, now we're just going to move on next. And the next topic for our question is, Slot, should humans, we've been doing it now for quite a long time, for decades, since 1969, of course, it's been majorly in the public view. Should humans explore space? Should we be sending probes into space to discover things? There are benefits, of course, but is it worth the enormous effort and the expense of doing this? Well, to explore this, I have James Geary on the line. He's with the European Space Agency, and he's an engineer that has worked on many such projects. Welcome to the programme, James.
Thanks, Sean.
Well, you're Irish, first of all, aren't you, working with the European Space Agency? So maybe you could tell our listeners, what kind of projects have you worked on in your career then, and, you know, how interesting have they been?
Sure, Sean. Yeah, I'm Irish. I've been working for the agency for about 4 years now. Previously, I worked for a company based in Dublin doing fluid components for the Ariane 5 spacecraft. Since I joined the agency, I've worked on some human spaceflight programs, ATV, which is the automated transfer vehicle.
That's for the International Space Station, isn't that right? It docks with it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a transport ship we use for bringing goods and services to the International Space
Station. Sorry to cut across you, but like a supply ship, I suppose.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a fully automated vehicle as well. It's autonomous. There's no. It doesn't carry humans.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked predominantly in Earth observation on Meteosat programs and some Earth observation programs to do with monitoring magnetics of the Earth and gravitational pulls, etc., to Golgi emissions and swarm emissions.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of Earth observation from space, is it? Yes, exactly.
Anything to do with observing the Earth, whether it's weather-based or information we need to understand the science of Earth better, so we can possibly improve, if we can do something to understand better the effects of climate change, etc.
Okay, and maybe you could tell, I don't know if you're involved with anything at the moment, but is there much happening in terms of the manned missions, Europe or the Americans or anyone else at the moment?
Yeah, I don't work specifically in human spaceflight, but it's a very active sector. Recently, in January, we launched an ATV vehicle that went and docked with the International Space Station successfully and deployed its cargo and it returned, and now it burns up on reentry.
Mm-hmm.
That was very recent. The Russians are regularly launching. They have a Soyuz capsule and they launch in a Soyuz rocket. Our own ESA astronaut, our European Paolo Nespoli, was on board the last crew, and now he's on the International Space Station doing a number of activities. He was commander for the mission that docked with ATV, I guess, because he's European, he's familiar with the system.
Any Irish involved in that? I don't think there is. Is there any Irish astronauts involved?
No, there's no Irish astronauts. There was a recruitment campaign in 2008. Europe recruited 4 new astronauts. There were a number of applications from Ireland, and it was open to all participating states.
Mm-hmm. Highly competitive, of course, yeah.
Of course. I mean, generally the people who get selected have fighter pilot training or perhaps usually have PhDs and are quite experienced people.
Sure, so they're PhD fighter pilots. Not too many of them are.
Yeah.
Now, getting on to the question for the day then, I mean, sure. What your own opinion now, I know you don't speak on behalf of the agency as such, but you've been involved in a lot of things. What is the main justification? I know from my own point of view, I could understand when there was during the Cold War, where there was two superpowers and one was in space and the other felt they had to be in space too, and all these resources went in. That isn't there to the same extent anymore. I know that competition is coming back into it. So what is the real justification for putting vast amounts of money into space exploration of all kinds?
I guess, Sean, there's a number of different reasons. to a certain extent, that ego trip that you're talking about still does exist. We now have the Chinese who are really competing in space. They have their own manned mission as well now. They can launch men to space, and they have recently. So that ego boost is still, that ego trip is still there with nations. They want still to be the first. It still is a kick. I mean, even if you look at the likes of Richard Branson and what he's doing with his suborbital flights, this is people just want to go into space. It's almost, they pay $200,000 and they go to space and they come down with astronaut wings. And, So people are interested in it from, a personal point of view. But from what regards going into space and why we should explore it and the future of manned space, I guess Earth as a planet, over the years we've managed to, our population has increased, and now we've got to a point where we're really using up, usurping the resources at a very fast rate. Now we've managed to do some activities to slow this down, to recycling, etc., and these help, but sheer numbers, we are having problems to deal with resources. So using human space, we can look at either two different options, whether we can harvest resources from space, we can use comets or something, or different materials from the moon or whatever. These sound far-fetched, but these things are all being explored.
Mining materials are,
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We have if you're familiar with the Rosetta program at the moment, it's due to land on a comet in, I think, 2 years' time.
Sure.
Drill down and come back and send the details and let us know what's on the comet so that maybe we can use these minerals. Because this is a big issue on Earth, where all our minerals and resources are being used at such a huge rate. We consume so fast. Humans are like locusts. That's one reason for resources. You can also look at we need to also look at if we have to exit the planet. I mean, do we need to look at where we go or what we do? And if that point comes, then we need to do some background research and work. And Europe is focusing on Mars, and we're trying hard now to plan a manned space flight to Mars. I mean, our target goal is 25 years from now, and we've a number of probes in between there and now. And there's a number of technical challenges in order to get this. I mean, you have weightlessness, and you've bone marrow density in humans decreases due to the zero gravity, and your muscle tone, etc. But just getting back to the point, also, for instance, security. We need to consider things like using men and humans in a mission, something like Armageddon. Okay, I mean, this is all Hollywood-type scenarios, but we're getting to a point where our technology we've developed can now do things like this. We've had a number of killer asteroids pass quite close to Earth in the last number of years. I think it was in 2009 we had one that passed within 40,000 kilometers. This is the geobelt. I mean, this is where our communication satellites are. And we got 3 days' notice. Now, 3 days' notice doesn't give you much to do anything, So we need to, I think, use manned space flight to
look at this. And could I just ask you again, like, last question, because we're just tight on time. Ireland, very small country. What's in it for us? Why do we need to be involved in these massive projects, albeit on a small, I'm sure we're not contributing as much as obviously some of the larger European countries, but still we're involved. Is it worth our while?
Yes, it's based on a GDP, and you contribute a certain amount to the ESA budget, and you get so much back. Yeah, it's vital to the development of a country. If you need to be on these high tech programs to be involved, to get spin off technologies into your country. If you're not developing the technology, this high end technology in the country, you're not going to get the spin outs. And
so there's a business angle for us there, an enterprise angle as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. For sure.
James, listen, thanks a million. And maybe you could come on the program again and talk to us about other things that are going on at ASA, etc.
I'd be delighted, Sean. I've listened to your podcast, and there's some excellent pieces in there.
Okay. Thanks, James. Thanks very much now. Bye-bye.
No problem. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, now in our peek into the future slot, where we have a look at how things might be in coming decades, one thing that has always amazed me is how We design our buggies, even, for example, that we now have buggies that are very high-tech, the children's buggies, that are lightweight, that can be manipulated into any kind of positions, that are easy to push along. But what about wheelchairs? It seems that people in wheelchairs, they often get a bit left behind when it comes to science and technology. That's changing. There's signs that that's changing, and that's to be welcomed. But it still is quite amazing that there hasn't been that much work done on developing far better wheelchairs for the users in terms of how much they weigh, because obviously to get along in a wheelchair can be quite heavy. And that's one of the reasons something caught my eye again in the USA, student PhD candidate. We should be having PhD candidates in Ireland like this. Hopefully we will be in coming years, developing ideas that are very practical. But he's developed basically a gear shifter on the wheelchair so that can determine the amount of exertion that the person in the wheelchair is using to try and move it forward. So essentially it's a gear shifting operation, makes it easier for people to get around in wheelchairs. And he also has designed an ultralight wheelchair that weighs about 10 pounds. So that'll come as good news. Hopefully something like that he's done will be available in Ireland in coming years. His company is IntelliWheels Inc. Okay, now we're going to move on to our last guest. It's Wallace Arthur. He's Professor of Zoology at UCC in our writer's room slot. He's written a book recently, just out, called Evolution, a Developmental Approach. And he's on the line now. Hello, Wallace.
Hi, Sean. Can I just first of all correct you? I'm not in UCC.
Sorry.
I'm in NUI Galway.
Sorry. I have my note is wrong. I'm sorry about that.
No worries. I'd hit Cork to take the credit for my book.
No problem. I changed that unreservedly. So you're at NUI Galway.
Indeed.
Okay. So your book is Evolution, a Developmental Approach. Now, evolution is always a very hot topic in science.
Indeed.
And going right back to Darwin's time. But, you know, I suppose for our general listeners, you know, what has changed since Darwin's time? What do we now know about evolution, maybe, that we didn't know then?
Yeah, well, Sean, that's a very interesting question, and I could spend a very long time answering it, but I appreciate that we don't have a very long time.
Mm.
To me, the single most important thing, after the discovery of the structure of DNA by Watson and Crick in the 1950s. The most important thing, especially underlying this book that I've written, was a discovery that's not at all so familiar to non-scientists as the discovery of DNA structure.
Mm-hmm.
This was a discovery made in 1984. And it was, like a lot of scientific discoveries, it was made independently at about the same time in two different laboratories, one in this case, one in Indiana and one in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
Rather strange discovery, a discovery of a particular DNA sequence that's buried in quite a lot of genes in pretty much every animal in the entire animal kingdom. And we give it a funny name. We call this DNA sequence the homeobox sequence. And to explain what it is, it's a bit that occurs within lots of different genes, as I say, in lots of different animals, which means that its protein product is going to actually come back into the nucleus and switch other genes on and off. And so this is something, of course, that Darwin didn't know at all about. It's to do with embryos, embryonic development, but not just from a descriptive point of view, which was something they could do in Darwin's day, but rather analyzing the causality of how the developmental process works.
Does this mean then that a baby in their mother's womb, that they're actually getting some kind of feedback from their mother, maybe in terms of if the mother is stressed out, or is there something more to it than just the basic DNA structure? It's more flexible. Is that what you're saying?
That's not especially what I am saying. It's but nevertheless, what you say is true. I mean, and some things that happen, if you're talking about the human animal in particular, then yes, some of the things that happen to the embryo in the womb may affect its development one way or another. But no, I suppose the most... The exciting thing about the discovery of the homeobox when it was made in 1984 was this was the first time that we realized that actually effectively the same set of genes, which some people call the genetic toolkit of the animal kingdom, is being used and actually used in similar sorts of ways to make animals that are as different as a human, a fruit fly, a jellyfish, and so on. And so before this discovery, we thought that since the outcome of the developmental process was so different, it led to the production of very different adult animals,
yes,
such as the ones I've just mentioned, we discovered at this point that actually there is this commonality in the development of all animals. And this came as something of a shock and a pleasant surprise at the time, and has given rise to what's sometimes now referred to as the new science of Evo-Devo, which is a nickname because, well, the overall name, evolutionary developmental biology, is a bit of a mouthful. And so my book really focuses on this so-called new science of Evo-Devo, which really erupted out of that one discovery in 1984.
Right, and actually, we're just running very short of time. I'm very sorry, but this book it's obviously something that anybody could read. I mean, it's accessible. Where can they get it?
Well, they should be able to get it, as they say, at any good bookshop.
Yeah, or online as well.
And of course, these days, online, Amazon, everywhere. The publisher is Wiley Blackwell, and they, of course, have an online site where people can buy all their books, and that might be the most obvious place to go. As you say, it was deliberately written to be accessible, and it's full of color pictures, which most Evo-Devo books are not.
Yeah, so it's well worth, if you're interested in evolution, it's well worth a look. Thanks very much for coming on, Professor.
You're welcome.
Professor Wallace Arthur there at NUI Galway.